tonight, and I want to start tonight by telling a story that involves this woman. Her name is Lima Bowe. I believe is that how you pronounce it? Lima Bowe. She's from Liberia, which is in West Africa, and she lived through a 14-year civil war in West Africa that happened primarily under the presidency of a man named Charles Taylor. This is not the Canadian philosopher, Charles Taylor, for those who know. This is a different man, an awful man, who was democratically elected by the people of Liberia, but really was a dictator. To give you an idea of the 14-year civil war, in Liberia, it's estimated, conservative estimation was that 75% of the social infrastructure that kept the country going was destroyed during that 14-year civil war. There are many stories, documented cases of child soldiers, cannibalism, and a 2005 study from the World Health Organization said that 90% of the women in Liberia during this 14-year period, 9 out of 10 women, who were non-combatants, they were not fighting, because this is a African hierarchical society, women are not fighting, but 90% of them suffered from physical or sexual abuse. And some people have said for during this 14 years, Liberia was the rape capital of the world. This was a very, very awful place. And this woman, Lima Bowe, who is a Christian, was not a particularly good Christian at this stage in her life. She was living with a man who was not her husband. She didn't consider herself particularly devout. But she had a dream. And in the dream, she heard a voice tell her, "Gather the women to pray. Gather the women to pray." And she said, in this country, in this culture, I can't stand in front of a church and speak because I'm not a good Christian, because I'm sort of living in sin. So this actually isn't true. I'm just making this up." But it stuck with her, and it worked on her for a long time. And so she eventually gathered a group of women to pray for peace in this country that is torn apart by civil war. And so what they did was they gathered together to pray, to sing, to dance, and to carry signs saying, "The women of Liberia," I think it says there, "Wake up, women of Liberia, our nation needs peace." And they decided to protest and do this on a soccer field that was in a public place that this guy, Charles Taylor, would drive by every day from his palace on his way to the parliament in the morning, and then from the parliament back home in the evening. They wanted his attention. They wanted to show that the women of Liberia wanted peace. And you can see in this picture that they're wearing white shirts. And they all chose to wear white shirts to symbolize a humble, wholehearted commitment, not to sort of partisan politics, but to peace. They wanted to have what they wore symbolize what they were after. And their motivation for what they were doing was actually Esther from the Bible. So they start doing these demonstrations, and then Taylor bans them. He says, "No more demonstrations. If there's a demonstration, you get thrown in jail." The next day, 2,500 women show up in the same place doing the same thing. And they stayed there for a week doing this every single day. And it was primarily Christian women, but it was also Muslim women as well. It was an interfaith kind of call for peace and call for it was a call for peace. They were there 12 hours a day. They chanted, they prayed, they held signs, and they danced. They said, "The women of Liberia want peace now." Bowe said that this whole movement was prompted by emotion, by women's exhaustion and desperation, but there was nothing spontaneous about it. Managing a huge daily protest was a complicated task, and we planned every move we made. These women, who were powerless in a hierarchical African society, decided to give Taylor 3 days to respond to their demands. When he didn't respond to their demands at all, they decided they were going to move their protest from this soccer field to the parliament building. So they moved to the parliament building. They stood in the rain, they stood in the sun for 3 days, and after 3 days, he said, "Okay, I'll meet you at my palace. Come and speak to me in my home." So all of these women go and meet him. And this woman, Lima Bowe, is sort of the representative. And I've seen some video of this. It's actually quite amazing. There's 2,500 women standing in the sort of courtyard of this royal palace, and this evil dictator, this man in full military garb, wearing sunglasses, dark black sunglasses, even though he's in the shade, sort of covering his eyes, is sitting there, and she addresses him, and she says this. And this is a quotation. "The women of Liberia, including internally displaced persons," which is people who've lost their home in a war, "we are tired of war. We are tired of running. We are tired of begging for bulgur wheat. We are tired of our children being raped. We are now taking this stand to secure the future for our children, because we believe, as custodians of society, our children will ask us, 'Mama, what was your role during the crisis?' And we will have an answer." So, and after this compelled Taylor, trying to be pushed into peace talks by other heads of state. This interaction with these women compelled him to finally attend peace talks in Ghana. And Bawe later said about her interaction of speaking to him, she said, "The only language he knows is violence. And you come at him with nonviolence, and he didn't know how to function." And she said he couldn't handle that nothing negative was being said about him. He couldn't handle it, because you heard what she said. So Taylor goes to Ghana to these peace talks. A large group of women followed him to Ghana, just to make sure he's actually going to do what he said he was going to do. And meanwhile, back in Liberia, the war rages on. The worst parts of the war happened during these peace talks. And the women continue to sit, chant, pray, and talk during what was scheduled as a three-week meeting but turned into 3 months of meeting that had no end in sight. So the women decided to lock arms and said, "We are not going to leave till an agreement has been hammered out." So they were told that if they didn't leave, they were going to be arrested and sent home and put in jail. And so they said, "Well, we're going to stay. We're not leaving until you do what we ask, until you take this seriously." And the armed security guards who are there come to arrest the women, and her response is incredibly surprising. She stood up to the guards and she said, she threatened to take her clothes off. She said, "If you come to arrest me, I'm going to take my clothes off." And this is what she said later about it. She said, "If you think you can humiliate..." She didn't say this in the moment, but this is what she said later. She said, "If you think you can humiliate me with an arrest, watch me humiliate myself more than you have dreamed of." And this is a culture, that's the end of the quotation, it's a culture where men have been violently undressing and raping women for the 14 years during this war. But she has this response, and none of the guards touch them. And they don't get arrested. And actually, 3 weeks later, there's a lot of internal pressure as well. There's a lot of other things going on as well. But 3 weeks later, an agreement is signed. Taylor resigns. He's sent into exile and ultimately to prison for crimes against humanity, and the civil war in Liberia ends. Not to say that Liberia is a lovely, peaceful, flourishing society today. It was a society that has been destroyed. 14 years of civil war don't just solve themselves after a peaceful thing. And a huge part of what kept Liberia together has been the presence of UN troops that sort of kept a fragile peace there. But I tell this story because would this sort of peace happen if these women didn't choose to act in the way that they did? I don't have an answer exactly to that question. But I think it's a compelling story of people engaging violence through nonviolence. And I wanted to start with a story because I think stories help. Well, it puts a face on it, for one, what we're sort of talking about tonight. Tonight might fly a little high at some points. So it touches down to how this reality is lived out. And I'm going to move from here, go kind of to the complete opposite end of things, and give you a quote from a philosopher. And unlike most quotes from a philosopher, I think this one is very helpful. And I've probably used this in a quote in a lecture here before. But this is from a Catholic philosopher named Alistair MacIntyre. And he says, "I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I can answer the prior questions, of what, or prior question of what story or stories do I find myself apart? So McIntyre is making a point that our identity, our values, and ultimately our ethics draw upon big stories that we give to the world. We make sense of the world we live in by giving the world a story. It has a beginning, it has this present moment we're in, and it's going somewhere. And these stories help us give the world value, give the world meaning, and help us have meaningful engagement, do something with the stuff of this world. And I think this is a helpful way into the things I want to share tonight, some preliminary reflections on violence and nonviolence, because I want to think, what does the Christian story have to say about these realities, and what do sort of competing stories have to say about this? McIntyre highlights the fact it's not just that we live in one story, we live in a society where there's multiple stories that give the world meaning, give the world purpose, and often they're in competition with each other. So that's what I want to do. And I'm going to start by just going ahead and giving some definitions to violence and nonviolence that I want to talk about. So these are working definitions. I did not make up either of them. So this first one is a definition of violence that comes from, he's actually now an editor of Christianity Today, but his name is Andy Crouch, and he says this: violence is a force that is intended to damage, a force that undermines dignity. Violence does not respect its object's limits and intended good. And then here is a definition of nonviolence that comes from a sociologist named Ronald Sider, or maybe just Ron Sider. He says, nonviolence is a confrontation with evil that respects the personhood of the enemy and therefore seeks both to end the oppression and reconcile the oppressor. And to sort of flesh out a little bit with the first definition of violence, what he's talking about, Crouch says this: the potential for violence increases not just with our physical ability to exert force, but with the dignity of the target of our force. This is the reason we most often use the word violence to refer to force used disproportionately and degradingly against human beings. Of all things in the world, humans are the ones with the most dignity to lose, so they are the ones most vulnerable to violence. So he's saying the more dignity something has, the more susceptible it actually is to having violence perpetrated against it. So an example, if I punch someone in the face, a person in the face, I'm robbing them of dignity. But if I punch the granite posts that are out in front of this house, I'm not robbing them of dignity in the same way, and I'm hurting my hand a whole lot more. So, which I think that helps kind of place, because it's not the problem. The problem is not just force. The problem is not just engaging. It's what the point, or what makes violence what it is. Is this undermining of dignity? And I'll just put it out there in the beginning. I think there are times where violence is justifiable and important, and maybe necessary, not important, in a fallen world. And then nonviolence. Nonviolence is sometimes associated with pacifism, with passivity, with non-engagement. And there's reasons for that, but it's a way to engage circumstances of violence with the hope of persuading, intervening, or compelling those perpetrating violence, but without undermining their or damaging their dignity. So those are sort of the working definitions kind of have in your mind as these words are going to be sort of thrown around a bit tonight. And before I jump in a little more, I just want to say why I thought this could be a good idea for a lecture. El Labrie, because especially the last few weeks, I've been wondering, why did I ever want a lecture on this? I've had a few students ask me questions about how on earth Christianity went from the teaching of Jesus that says, love your enemy, turn the other cheek, things we're going to talk about later, to being used as a religious justification for unspeakable acts of violence and war. I'm not answering that question tonight for many reasons. But I also think one of the other reasons is we live in a moment where a lot of people in the evangelical church, I think, are not properly or adequately uncomfortable with how violent things are in our society. And I think also being in a political, I'll just put my cards on the table. The way evangelical Christians have supported Donald Trump early on, and not just, well, for there's any number of reasons, but especially his his rhetoric and promises of violence and the inciting to violence that a lot of Christians are just unpulsed by. It's not really a problem. And the other question, or the other reason, the final reason, is I think over the last 50 years, if not longer, Christianity has become more and more irrelevant to the surrounding culture. It doesn't mean much anymore. But that culture has continued to change. Its morals, its values have changed. And I wonder if in the next 50 years, Christianity will be seen as immoral. Not just irrelevant, but immoral. Because of things we believe about the world, things we believe about truth, things we believe about people. And so I wonder if we'll be in a position, I'm not prophesying or forecasting anything, I don't know, but I wonder if we'll be in a position sometime in the future where we'll have more enemies than we thought we did. And we'll have to think through how do we engage with our enemies. There's more to say, but so what I want to do again is look at big stories. Actions arise out of big stories, or ethics arise out of big stories we give to the world, and particularly what these stories have to say about violence. And I want to compare some stories with the biblical story. And then I want to look particular at the life and teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Paul, and then I want to tell you about how the Christian tradition has tried to navigate its way of trying to be people who make peace in a world of violence. And so I'm going to jump right in with other stories, competing stories of what is really true about the world. And I'm going to start with an ancient account of how the world came to be, of human origins. So this word up here, this word theomachy, is a word that historians and scholars use to describe origin stories of ancient cultures. And it's two Greek words together. It's theomachy. You can see that if you've read it. But it means gods and fighting. So gods fighting. And it's a categorization that works for a lot of creation stories of Israel's neighbors. The Canaanites, the Sumerians, but I want to talk particularly about the Babylonian account. This was sort of a competing story on what's true about the world, where did the world come from, that one of Israel's neighbors were often telling. And it's also, of these other neighboring stories, it's one of the most well-known. And so it's a story that's told in the Enuma Elish. Anyone's heard about this? This guy right here with the bow and arrow. So this is an engraving, and this is a drawing of it. This guy with the bow and arrow right here is a mean dude called Marduk. And he is the primary god of the Babylonians. And this this poor person right here is Tiamat. And so in the Babylonian story of where the world came from, Marduk and Tiamat are battling. Tiamat is a goddess of water, and Marduk, again, is the main god, and they're battling. And at one point, for some reason, Tiamat has her mouth open, and she's going like this. So Marduk sends a great wind, and while the wind is going, it keeps her mouth open, and her mouth is open. And he uses that moment to shoot an arrow down her throat. And he shoots an arrow down her throat, and he goes to retrieve it, and he grabs her by the cheeks, and he pulls her body and tears her body in two and kills her. And then out of her dead body, he makes the world. He makes people. He makes the soil. He makes seeds. He makes the sky. So in the Babylonian account of the world, being human was to be made from the corpse of a defeated and murdered goddess. The world you lived in was the result of a violent celestial conflict, and that violent conflict was literally in your bones and flowing through your veins. This, of course, sets a precedent for how people understood themselves, understood the nature of the world, and what was most true about the world. And it's a narrative where violence and war and conflict are at the origins. So violence is original. I'll say that a couple other times. I don't mean original in that it's creative. I just mean original in the sense that it was at the start. So it's a story where violence is original. And this is not just true of ancient people. We make quite a big leap from the Babylonians to Thomas Hobbes and Nietzsche. But Thomas Hobbes was many things, but he is kind of an architect of modern political theory of how we understand what the state is. And he wrote this book called Leviathan. You can read it right there. And in the first book, he describes the natural state of humanity. And he says it's one of chaos, fear, violence. He says people were solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and life was short. And he goes on to say, life was a war of all against all. So again, at the origins, so gone are the gods, right? Gone are these mythical creatures. But still, at the origins of being human is violence, is war. And that's for Hobbes where a state comes in, there's a social contract where we suspend our natural behavior in order to get along and have some semblance of a peace. So the state comes in sort of to control. And then to Hobbes's, well, that's not actually a picture of Hobbes. It's the cover of the book. I don't think Hobbes carried that. Maybe he did. I don't think he carried those things around. But Nietzsche, who is a philosopher who is very much... has very much shaped eventually postmodern discourse, postmodern suspicion of basically everything, where for Nietzsche, I always hesitate to say his word out loud in public, or his name in public, I don't know if it's Nietzsche, but for Nietzsche, we're gonna stick on that one. We can return to that in the questions. For him, what was most true about our social institutions, so our governments, our churches, our economics, what's most true about our relationships to our parents, to our children, to our friends, to our husbands, to our wives, is what he calls the will to power. And it's ultimately what motivates us, what drives us in the world, is a will to have power over and against someone. So again, it's a vision where being human is one of being over and against someone else. This is also true in social Darwinism, and other sort of more modern theories where we've, again, dispensed of the primitive battling gods, and we have more scientific or maybe materialistic accounts of the world, but they're big stories where at the origin is violence. And there's a sense where there's some truth to this. When you look at the world, you have to admit the world is pervaded by violence. It's filled with violence. And there's still some truth into what's being said about here. So the beginning, the origins of being human in these stories, these very, very different stories to help make sense of the world, is original violence. And this is a picture of a sociologist named C. Wright Mill, who is an American sociologist of a previous generation, and he said this. He said, all politics is a struggle for power, and the ultimate form of power is violence. So again, this is we've moved well beyond Tiamat being killed by Marduk, but still violence is at the origins. But in the middle, violence is the greatest form of power. How do you beat violence? More violence, stronger violence. And so that's just flying over at 1,000 feet. And I want to contrast this to the biblical story. To what Genesis has to say about the origins. In the Bible, we're given a markedly different story of the world where violence is neither original, it's not at the start, it's not the ultimate form of power, and it won't be final. Violence, like sin and evil, is an intruder into God's good world. So again, remembering the original violence and chaos that characterized these other accounts, we see something really, really different in the Genesis account of human origins, where it envisions, the Genesis account envisions one creator God not fighting any other gods, who has absolute power, and he speaks the world into existence. And it is one that's ordered and peaceful. You can see how God makes habitats in the first 3 days, and then he fills them with inhabitants. And it culminates here on that part with humans being installed as his images, people who exercise his domain, who sustain that peace, who keep things in order, who do things with the world. So it's a very different story. But more amazingly in this story, not just that God made the world by himself, this God likes the world he made. In Genesis 1, there's this refrain over and over again that it was good, that God saw that it was good. And this word good is a Hebrew word, tov, and it has moral aspects to it. But it's primarily an aesthetic word. It's a word that's used of pleasure throughout the Old Testament. So lotion on dry skin, bread dipped in oil, shade under a tree. These are all things that are tov. And God looks at his world and says his world is good. And it's an ordered world. And it's a world, and the people within it are not the haphazard, messy remnants of a violent cosmic battle, but they are the cherished work of a loving and all-powerful craftsman or creator. And so this is a quote here from Tim Keller, the pastor of Redeemer Church in New York. He said, God made the world not as a warrior digs a trench, but as an artist makes a masterpiece. And it's a world that's good. And violence is not on the scene. It's not part of the warp and woof of God's intention for his world. It's an intruder. It comes after the fall. Again, it's a foreigner. And so, though the world was originally good in Genesis 1, it's also a world that is now fallen. It's not the way things are supposed to be. Sin has entered the world. People have refused to live in God's world, in God's way. And we talk about that here as we live in the shadow of the fall. And so where there's broken relationships between humans, humans as a whole and God, humanity as a whole and God, humanity as a whole and the rest of the created order, individual humans within themselves, and then also between other humans. So there's broken relationships between people. And it's not long... the fall is in Genesis 3, and we're not that many verses into Genesis 4 before the first act of violence happens, before Cain hits Abel. So it doesn't show up until sin has come in and corrupted the world. And it's interesting, too, in Genesis 4, when it tells the story of Cain killing his brother Abel, this original account of violence, there's way more space given to how God responds to violence than to the violence itself. God's response is not one of reciprocity, like sort of the warring gods of Israel's neighbors, but God marks Cain so that no one else will take him out. So God meets the initial incident of violence with grace. But from here, violence builds and it escalates, it tarnishes everything, and it characterizes the world we live in. So it's present in the world, but it's not the way the world is supposed to be. And in the same way that I jumped from the Babylonians to Thomas Hobbes, I'm going to take another jump now that's not as far. But jumping from Genesis 3 to partway through the biblical story, we encounter the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, who lived in a world pervaded by violence. But they dreamed of a world, they received a vision of what this world could be like if sin and evil and violence were removed. A world that is characterized by this word, shalom. Theologian Cornelius Plantinga, in a great book that we have on the shelf called Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, summarizes the vision of shalom that the Hebrew prophets had like this, that they were given by God, of this is what God wanted to do with his world that's now fallen. They had a vision of a time, a new age, in which human crookedness would be straightened out. Rough places would be made plain, the foolish would be made wise, and the wise made humble. A time when the deserts would flower, the mountains would run with wine, weeping would cease, and people would go to sleep without weapons on their laps. People would work in peace, and work would be fruitful again. All humans would be knit together in brotherhood and sisterhood, and all nature and all humans would look to God, be with God, lean towards God, and delight in God. So for the Hebrew prophets, this is what God wanted to bring to the world. He wanted to renew the peace that was at the beginning. He wanted to bring shalom. And shalom is not just the absence of violence, but it's the active presence of universal flourishing, wholeness, and delight. So again, it's not just the absence of violence, but it's the presence of right relationships. So I talked about how the fall was broken relationships between God and people, people and the earth, people and other people, people and themselves. The idea of shalom is that God restores all of those things that are broken. He doesn't just take violence away. But for a world of violence to become a world of peace, wrongs have to be righted, made right, and evil and violence have to be dealt with. And this peace, the shalom, that the prophets were inspired by, lies on the other side of God's judgment of the world. And in our day and age, this is a particularly unpopular aspect of the Christian faith. To think of God as a judge sounds cruel, vindictive, makes him appear pretty petty, and just kind of ungodlike. Why would a God do something like this? Who does he think he is to judge and punish anyone? And it's understandable why people feel that way, because often the way God's punishment or God's judgment on the world is presented makes God sound that way. But the biblical story, the end of the story, right before Shalom happens, tells the story of God's judgment, not one of him being petty and vindictive and cruel, but about one him righting the wrongs of the world in order to bring peace. So Revelation chapter 19 tells the story of God's final judgment on sin, evil, wickedness, and violence, and it describes it as a great war in which Jesus, and Jesus alone, is described as a warrior riding triumphantly on a white horse, his armies following him, but his armies don't engage in the battle. Jesus himself, and Jesus alone, is the one who casts the beast and the false prophet. These are symbolic ways of talking about evil, violence, sin, throws them into a fiery lake, and then he kills the followers of these ones. And so whatever is being conveyed through the very disputed and symbolic language of the book of Revelation, what's clear is that God, is through his judgment, is bringing an end to violence. One of the ways that these people that God is that Revelation describes the people God brings judgment upon are those who are drunk with the blood of the innocent. So this is God not being petty and vindictive because you stole a candy bar. This is God dealing with the problems of the world like Charles Taylor. Like people that, well, you know what I mean. So judgment in the biblical story is the final end of evil, sin, and violence, so God can usher in shalom. And this is a great quote from a theologian named Miroslav Volf, who also is a very sharp dresser, as you can see. But he says this about the logic of judgment. He said, God will judge not because God gives people what they deserve, but because some people refuse to receive what no one deserves. If evildoers experience God's terror, it will not be because they have done evil, but because they have resisted to the end the powerful lure of the open arms of the crucified Messiah. So the biblical story is one where God is making a world of peace, of justice, of truth, a world of shalom. And he does that by making an end to deception, injustice, and violence that has characterized the world since Cain killed Abel. And Wolf puts it like this, and you can see this in contrast to ancient and modern stories, where violence is at the beginning, in the middle, violence is the strongest form of power, and then violence is ultimately the end. Wolf says this, he says, violence is not human destiny because the God of peace is the beginning and the end of human history. So I've flown over those things pretty fast. But again, we've talked about stories, how we're going to engage in the world, what we're supposed to do with this world flows out of what stories we understand are given to the world. And we've seen that peace and violence, world violence, is understood differently in different stories of the world. And now I want to, we've talked about, for these other competing stories, how violence is original. In the middle, it's the greatest form of power, and then so it's this unavoidable end of humanity. But like Wolf says, in the biblical story, the God of peace is the beginning and the end. And so I want to look at the middle now, and I want to look at Jesus and Paul in particular. And the way I want to start talking about it is looking at Jesus' understanding of being the Messiah. In case people don't know, the Bible doesn't start with Jesus. He comes more than halfway through it. And before him is the story of Israel, the Old Testament. And at the end, the people of God, Israel, have been put into exile. And they're no longer living in the land that God had promised them. And then some of them have been able to return to the land, but not in the condition that they once had. And so they're waiting for a Messiah, which means an anointed one, for someone to come and set things right and make things right, to restore, to realize God's promises to his people. But what, how people understood what a Messiah was someone who would come and through a violent military operation would crush their enemies and return the people to the land that they saw as their own. And where this idea comes from, and I'm picking this up from a New Testament person, scholar, yeah, that's a scholar, N.T. Wright, where he says it's shaped by something called, well, shaped by this guy over here called Judas Maccabeus. So about 200 years before Jesus was born, Palestine was taken over by the Greeks, who, among other things, outlawed the Jewish faith and practice under the penalty of death. And some of the Jews were not going to have that. So under the leadership of this guy, Judas Maccabeus, and that Maccabeus literally means hammer, so he's like a tough guy, they took up arms, they took up swords, and somewhat miraculously overtook their Gentile oppressors. They killed thousands along the way. This is a totally inexplicable thing. They were tiny in comparison to the Greeks, but they beat them. And they reclaimed their religious and national freedom and inaugurated something of a quasi-messianic kingdom through violent force. This military campaign deeply shaped the way first century Jews understood and anticipated God's kingdom, how God was going to bring shalom to the world. And they understood it through the edge of a sword. So this guy, Judas Maccabeus, sets up this quasi-messianic kingdom that lasts for about 80 years. His grandnephew was a guy named Aristobulus, who was also a ruler, and he killed his own brother, this guy Aristobulus, and starved his own mother to death in order to secure his kingship over the people. And then the king after him was a guy named Alexander Janneus, I'm sorry about the pronunciation, I should just say it, no one knows anyway, Alexander Janneus, and he formed this impressive standing military, and he expanded the borders, actually, of Israel and fought off Greek invaders, but did so at a tremendous price to his own people. The Jewish historian Josephus recounts how on one occasion he crucified 800 Pharisees, and he butchered the Pharisees' wives and children before their eyes while they were being crucified. And he did this while he was reclining amidst his concubines and enjoying the spectacle. So this Maccabean dynasty was one marked by violence. But it didn't last long. It lasted about 80 years until a Roman general came and squashed it and Rome took over. But the memories of this Maccabean revolt and this time where the Jewish people were not under oppression really shaped the imagination of how many in Israel anticipated their Messiah. He would be Maccabean-like. And we see this in a few of Jesus' contemporaries or sort of other candidates for being Messiah. Around the time Jesus was 12, there was a guy named Judas, who was not Judas Iscariot from the Bible, but who tried to overthrow Rome and establish God's kingdom. And this happened just a few miles away in, from Nazareth, where Jesus was. And it gained some traction and some popular support, but it was crushed by Rome. This guy Judas had two sons, Jacob and Simon, who followed in their father's footsteps, both in trying to start a violent revolt against Rome and both being crushed by Rome. This continued after Jesus' life and ministry. About 30 years after Jesus died, there were two other figures, Menahem and Simon ben Giora. Same thing happened. We can keep going on and on. This is these coins right here at the bottom are coins that were minted. Actually, I'm confused with what I've written here, so we're just going to skip what that is. But there were others, there are many, many other instances of people trying to start violent revolutions, understanding that they were God's anointed, that they were going to establish God's kingdom in the same way that the Maccabeans did. And this was not just political freedom, this was theological freedom. This wasn't just political oppressors, these were pagans who had come and polluted God's holy land. And so it's theological and it's political. So Jesus' world was filled... Oh, actually, and so this sword that's up there is a dagger. There were groups of Jews called Sicarii who wandered through Jerusalem, and they would sneak up on Roman sympathizers or Roman soldiers and stab them with these blades and then run away. This was their way of trying to wreak havoc on the Roman Empire and to fight back, to resist.
Is that in Jesus' time?
This was in Jesus' time, yeah. And so Jesus' world was filled with violence, with people taking up arms in the name of God for the purposes of advancing God's kingdom, advancing God's way of ruling the world, and anticipating that through them God would bring about shalom. These were all sort of candidates for Messiah. And into this world, Jesus steps in, and according to the Gospel of Mark, starts his ministry by saying, "The time has come near, the kingdom of God has drawn near. Come, let us repent and believe in the gospel." So Jesus is taking familiar words, kingdom, gospel. Even the word gospel had a political pre-life. It meant good news of victory at some battle that was happening somewhere else. Jesus is taking these all too familiar words and concepts into his own day, radically, radically redefining them, both through the model of his life and the contents of his teaching. And we see this very clearly in Jesus' teaching on what to do with your enemies. And I'm going to look at some verses. We're going to look together, probably way too briefly, at some verses from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. And I'm going to read this because I've combined a couple translations. I'll just read it out loud. "You folks have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you folks, don't use violence to resist evil. Instead, when someone hits you on the right cheek, turn the other one toward him. When someone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your cloak. And when someone forces you to go 1 mile, go a second mile with him. Give to anyone who asks you, and don't refuse someone who wants to borrow from you. You have heard it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for people who persecute you. That way you'll be children of your Father in heaven." And so a lot of translations of this, I'll just say a word about some of the things that have been bolded. Just a lot of translations just say, "you have heard," but it's a plural word there. Jesus is speaking to a group of people. You folks have heard. And often verse 39 has been translated since the New King James as "don't resist an evil person." But the Greek word there really means "don't violently resist." And this, I chose the translation, N.T. Wright translates it, "don't use violence to resist evil," in his translation of the New Testament. So Jesus here fleshes out for us what it means to not use violence to resist evil. And he gives us 5 commands, which he scatters over life, over all of our life. And in a sense, he invites us to become a certain type of person who responds in certain ways to evil. So I think these are less directives than they are directions. Jesus is setting us in a direction, calling us to become a type of person. The whole context of the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus is giving what would be relatively counterintuitive understanding of the world, where the ones who are blessed are peacemakers, are people who are meek, are people who are persecuted, things that we don't kind of naturally see ourselves. So the first area where Jesus talks about not resisting or not using violence to resist evil is the most famous one, most likely, where he says, if someone hits you on the right cheek, turn the other one towards him. And right here, Jesus gets at our sense of justice. It's like he knows our immediate reaction to ill treatment is most likely going to be flight or fight. Fight or flight. Those are kind of the two things. But Jesus is saying real power, real engagement with evil is going to look different than those things. He says, for me, my response is flight. I want to run away. I don't like being hit, and I don't like the idea of being hit again. But Jesus says to someone who wants to run from evil, to not engage with evil, he says, turn towards them. look at the person that hits you. And then the person whose impulse is fight, someone who wants to get even, someone who wants to pay back, someone who wants to teach a lesson. Jesus, in a sense, agrees that who's ever hit you needs to learn a lesson. It's just most likely not the lesson you want to teach them in that moment. There's something else going on. And so Jesus calls us to a nonviolent, creative engagement with violence. The way I thought about what Jesus is doing here is when someone hits you on the right cheek, in a sense, they're putting an exclamation point on that statement we read before, that violence is the ultimate form of power in the world. And Jesus is sort of saying, when you turn your other cheek towards him, you're changing the exclamation point into a question mark, right? You're completely turning the situation on its head. Jesus is calling us to show up in situations of evil, but not to respond in like manner. He's calling us to be creative people who make peace with our enemies, who don't just respond to our enemies. There's a verse in Proverbs that I think gets around how difficult of a thing this is, because it takes real power to control or change our impulse, to fight or flight. Proverbs 16 says, "He who rules his spirit is mightier than he who rules a city." So Jesus is calling us to an active pose, not a passive capitulation or pessimistic resignation. Jesus is calling us to become a different type of person. You can't just hear, if someone hits you on the cheek, give him your other cheek, and then think, well, when that happens, I'll most likely do that. There needs to be a transformation that's going on. We need to see the world differently. And Jesus is inviting us to see the world differently. And I'll just say, too, what's important here is Jesus is not saying if someone slaps your neighbor on the cheek, turn your neighbor's other cheek so that the other neighbor can be slapped. If this verse is being used to justify battered wives or abusive relationships to sort of stain, it's completely missing the point. Jesus is calling us to engage creatively and imaginatively with violence and not meet it on its own terms. And I'm gonna say it. Dick told me a story earlier in the week that I think captured the heart of what Jesus is after here, really beautiful. It's from was he the founder of the Dutch Livery? He's been involved with a man who's been involved with the Dutch Livery for years, who spent a tremendous amount of his own time and resources. He's on the city council in the city where the Dutch Livery is, working with the city council in Utrecht, which is in the Netherlands, to build a monument to Jews that were killed in World War II. And so through a lot of work, through a lot of time, it finally happened. And it's a monument that's actually on the platform at the train station where they were deported.
From Utrecht.
In Utrecht that were taken to concentration camps. So it's put right in the place where evil happened. This unthinkable evil that happened in this cultured university city in Europe. And it has the names of all of the people. It has the names of the victims. Mm. And a journalist, most likely with quite ill will, looked up all of the names and found one person on that list who actually didn't die, who didn't die in a concentration camp, and then used that to say, look, this is a shoddy monument. This is something that hasn't been cared for well, and used it as a way to attack all this work that Wim had done to create this thing. But Wim's response, his immediate response was to say, I'm so glad you found this person. I'm so glad that you found that there was one person that survived, because this person, amidst all of these other people, had to live in a world without family, without friends, and felt the long-term repercussions of all the evil that was perpetrated here in our city. And so there was this moment where something he's worked incredibly hard on and given his life to, and someone is just trying to attack him, make him look like an idiot. And what he does is he just turns the whole situation on its head, by, in a sense, agreeing with the man. And then, if I'm, how did it end? The journalist then changed, wrote another.
And they sort of, he tried to show that this woman, whose name was on there, who had not died, represents the many, many Jewish people who didn't die but had to live with the reality of the Holocaust years and years and years afterwards.
Yeah.
And so she is there representing all these millions of people who didn't actually die with it but have to live with it.
Yeah.
And so it's an appropriate thing to have her there. On the, and he came around and blew the horn on that too. He turned and agreed with them and they stood together.
Yeah.
With the guy, the journalist, actually changing the sides entirely.
Yeah. And there's another story that I think that puts flesh on what Jesus is after here, that I've heard, and I've spent the last week trying to find the exact source of where I've heard it, but I can't completely verify it. But during the Civil Rights Movement, a church was bombed in Alabama. And just a few days after the bombing happened, the members of this African-American church were having a memorial in front of the bombed-out church. But a group of white supremacists in the city had also planned a march that would go right by the church, right at the same time of the memorial. So clearly trying to provoke, clearly trying to humiliate. And so what the church did was, as the march rounded the corner, they actually stood and applauded and cheered for these people, and just said, you know, all right, yeah, go get them, keep going. And you could imagine how they just felt all the power had been pulled out, the rug had been pulled out underneath this march, right, and the whole thing. But anyway, I'm going to keep going because I've been already talking for 50 minutes. The second thing Jesus says is, if someone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your cloak. This is sort of like, if someone wants to sue you for your bike, give them your car. Like, just shower them with generosity. And it's a command that I think is played out really well in the story of Les Miserables, where if you shower your enemy with grace, you might just turn a thief into a saint. Jesus is looking for us to be creative people who are making peace. We're making peace with our enemies. This requires creativity and presupposes a transformed way of engaging with the world. The next one is political oppression. When someone forces you to go 1 mile, go a second mile with him. And that's, Palestine was an occupied territory by the Roman Empire, and they were able to force Jews to stop what they were doing and carry their weapons, carry all of sort of the implements of the oppression. They could force Jews to carry those for 1 mile. And so Jesus is calling his followers to carry a soldier's gear to ease the burden of their oppressors, these people that have invaded and polluted their land. And one commentator, I thought, captured this so well, and about how this is about making peace with our enemies creatively. He said, the first mile is the way that Jesus tells us to render to Caesar what is Caesar's, because legally you had to do this. And he said, the second mile that you walk with him is the way that we render to God what is God's. So in short, again, this is the way we make peace with our enemies. And the final thing, the final two, giving to those who ask, Jesus is again talking about showering, going above and beyond, responding differently. God is calling us to be people who make peace in creative, unexpected, imaginative ways. And he summarizes this whole thing by saying, I tell you folks, you people, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And what's fascinating, and I think really interesting to see continuity throughout the New Testament. Sometimes you'll hear someone say, Jesus said one thing, Paul said something completely different. Is to hear how the words of Jesus in Matthew 5 ring through Romans chapter 12. And I'm going to read them here. Paul unpacking what it means not to be conformed to this world. He says, abhor what is evil, Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Repay. I'm just pulling together. They're all throughout. Repay no one evil for evil. Live peaceably with all people. Never seek vengeance. Love your enemy and do good to those who hate you. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is just echoed all throughout Paul's teaching in Romans 12. And when Paul says here, never avenge yourself, it's the same logic in Paul that we kind of... But he says not to take vengeance because God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Because God is the one who will judge. God is the one who will make those who are drunk on the blood of the innocent be judged. But it's interesting that Paul's words here in Romans 12 butt up right against Paul's words in Romans 13, where Paul presents what justice looks like now in the muddled midi. Anyone have any questions? No. Muddled middle. So before God's final judgment, where Christians, in this time where Christians have been told not to take vengeance, Paul says this. So this is right after all of those things. Again, I'm just going to read them one more time that Paul says all throughout this. Abhor what is evil. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Repay no one evil for evil. Live peaceably with all people. Never seek vengeance. Love your enemy and do good to those who hate you. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And then Paul moves into the next chapter and he says, I'll read it. He says, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. And then this is I've highlighted, you can see I've emboldened this next part. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to authorities, not because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. So we see in these two paragraphs of Paul that Christians are called to be as pacific, as peaceful, as peacemaking as possible towards all evil, not avenging themselves. But yet the civil authorities, the state, in Paul's day, the Roman Empire is called to be as vigilant as possible in resisting evil for the sake of the community and the individuals within it. Paul says it's for your good. Paul refers to the state here as God's servant three times, twice in verse 4 and then once in verse 6, but I didn't put that up there. And this doesn't mean that Paul is giving the state a free pass to do whatever they want to do. Paul is talking about the same existing authorities that were persecuting churches he was establishing, that put him in prison, that crucified Jesus, all within Paul's lifetime. Yet Paul himself appealed to the Roman Empire as well to get out of trouble more than once. So what Paul has in mind here, I think, is not a complete baptizing of Rome's warfare policy against foreign nations. I think Paul is, not everything that the Roman Empire does, Paul is giving his stamp of approval on. Paul is saying, specifically, it's police and judicial action towards its own citizens within its own borders, with their attempt to sort of keep and sustain peace within the empire. So one scholar of Romans, a guy named Douglas Moo, talks about how Roman police officers were often referred to as sword bearers. And it is probably in reference... in reference to the fact that God uses unjust pagan governments to punish wrongdoings that he's getting out here. And this is the truth throughout the Old Testament. Multiple times, kings of foreign enemy pagan nations are called God's servant. Cyrus, king of Persia, in Isaiah 44 and 45, Nebuchadnezzar, in Jeremiah, as well as Assyria. They're all called God's servant, which doesn't mean God approves of everything they do, but it means that, and often, and we know that because these nations are often the recipients of God's wrath and God's punishment, but it means that they are not too far out of God's reach for God to use them to bring peace in the world. So it seems as though Paul, in Paul's mind, both the peacemaking Christian community and the coercive government authorities can somehow serve the law of love, which he talks about a little bit later in chapter 13, can advance God's purposes in the world. And this especially got tricky where Paul gives the state, at this point, the state, the existing authorities, there weren't many Christians in there. But as the empire became Christianized, Christians began to find themselves in positions of power, positions of authority, where they were carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders in some sense, and being called by God to do so. So Christians began to have to navigate, how do we obey God's call, Jesus' call, for us to be peacemaking people, but still work for a state that uses violence to sustain that peace. And part of that tension arose what's called the just war tradition in the Christian faith. And I'll say a little bit more in the beginning. This is not a uniquely or necessarily Christian way of navigating how we use violence in the world. The idea of a just war goes back to Aristotle, but it was primarily through the writings of Augustine, who, if anyone's here last term, I really like Augustine. But he stands behind the Christian appropriation of this thinking about violence and war. And so I think even the name itself gives us a clue that this doesn't mean all wars are good wars or this is a celebration of war. It is saying certain wars or certain forms of violence can be justified, can be just. And so they wanted, one scholar says what Augustine was after here was the formation of sad, reluctant soldiers, but people who were still willing to do what needed to happen to keep the peace. And so these are the seven criteria. The first one is called just cause, and this is the traditional component to this, or aspect of this, is intervention on behalf of those who are helpless. Now remember, Jesus' command to turn the other cheek is, again, not to turn your neighbor's cheek when your neighbor has been hit. The second is this idea of right authority. Only a legitimate government can wage war. So this rules out revolutionaries, criminal uprisings, militias. The third is right intention. So this is sort of weeding out the unjust purposes of war that characterize many, many wars. Vengeance, imperialistic advances, economic opportunities. All of these things cannot be included in right intention. Right intention has to be in line with this idea of just cause, helping those who are helpless. The next one is reasonable chance of success. That there are expected good results that must outweigh the bad results. The next one is last resort. All nonviolent routes must be exhausted before war begins. The sixth is proportionate means, where the weaponry and force should be limited to what is needed to repel aggression to secure peace. So total or unlimited war is ruled out by this idea of proportionate means. And then the final is non-combatant immunity. So civilians must not be targeted in war. So cities with civilians, medical personnel, POWs, etc. And sometimes, well, we live in cultures that can celebrate war, because war is a form of violence. Violence is considered the greatest form of power. But this is a quote from a prominent just war theory from, I don't know, 20 years ago or so, a guy named Arthur Holmes, who says this: war is evil. Its causes are evil. Its consequences are evil. It orphans and widows and horribly maims the innocent. It cheapens life and morality. Wars that are intended to arrest violence and injustice seem only in the long run to breed further injustice and conflict. To call war anything less than evil would be self-deception. That's from Arthur Holmes, who's a proponent of just wars, that there still can be ways of using violence to secure peace. Not all proponents of just war theory speak as negatively or critically as this guy Holmes does. But at its heart, it's the reality of living in a good world that's been fallen, that God is working towards building his shalom in, but we're not there yet. So how do we help sustain peace? And there's all sorts of criticisms of this tradition, of this theory. And a big part is it functions as a theory. It's something sort of retroactively, it can be sort of, it's a checklist that political policy can check off, that they can do after the fact. Again, like I said, it starts with Aristotle. It's not even shaped by necessarily Christian convictions. And then this guy Miroslav, this idea of just cause and right intention. Most people who go to war think their intentions are right or their cause is just. So it's an unhelpfully subjective category when it's taken apart from this Christian conviction that we're supposed to love our neighbors. But here's an example of how it's sort of slippery. September 11th, Osama bin Laden and his co-terrorists struck America as a response, they understood it, as a response to the pervasive immorality of exported American popular culture, as well as American military bases throughout the Middle East, which they perceived as unjust and unjust attacks, or unprovoked attacks. From their vantage point, September 11th was not an act of evil aggression, but a response to evil aggression that they have been the recipient of. So is it justified? Well, of course it's not. It's not justified at all. But it just shows how people go to war with different perceptions of just cause. And the thing that I think as well, this category of last resort. What's that? Oh, sorry. Practically speaking, one just war scholar has said, this has just fallen by the wayside. We attempt diplomacy. Diplomacy doesn't work. We go to war. And what I at least wanted to highlight with the story I told at the beginning was that there are other ways of approaching evil, of approaching violence, before we get to the part, before we have to engage in war. But that being said, it still is clear that Paul thinks Christians are to be involved in making peace, and sometimes the making of peace happens through the state bearing the sword. Christians are involved in the state. And so my thought in closing, as I'm still trying to navigate these things, is are Christians called to be bi-coastal people? And I'm not just saying that because my in-laws are here and they're from California. But as I said before, we see in Jesus' teaching and in Paul's teaching, Christians are called to be people who make peace. They're called to be pacific, right? People who make peace in the world. That's our primary calling. But at the same time, Paul sees that in a fallen world where shalom has not fully come, the state uses means of violence to sort of sustain peace for our own good, is what he said. And there are Christians who work in those structures of government, who work in those places, who are called to bear the weight of the world on their shoulders, like Atlantis. So that's the idea of the Atlantic and the Pacific. It's a little corny, but I think it captures the idea that we live in a complicated world that is pervaded by violence. But the biblical story says violence is not the beginning. It wasn't there at the start. Violence is not the ultimate form of power. We see that in Jesus' life, his taking violence on himself, defeating violence by absorbing violence, defeating death by absorbing death, and resurrecting to new life. And we see that the ultimate goal is not perpetual violence, but is shalom, is peace, that God will judge the evil that has characterized human existence since Cain and Abel. But we live in a complicated fallen world, and we are a part of the structures of this world, and our call is to make peace. So we're called to make peace non-violently, but perhaps those who are part of governmental structures are also called to make peace at the edge of a sword. And so, in some sense, I end with that question because I don't totally know how to wrap this all up in my own head. And as I've started to read and think about this more and more, the more complicated it gets. But I think there has to be space for Christians to understand themselves as people who make peace in the world. And sometimes the way peace is made is through the state. So it's made through nonviolent ways, then it can also be made through violent ways. So that's the whole bicoastal again, Pacific and then Atlantic, bearing the weight of the world but also making peace. So I'm going to stop there, and we normally do times of question and answer. Afterwards, if you need to go, you're free to go. I would like this to be a time of question and response, because I'm not sure I have all of the answers to these things, but I'll try to give a response. All right.
Well, I, as you process that Pacific and Atlantic question with me, you said something that you didn't include in your conclusion that I wonder if you would like to say, and that is...
I probably would. Actually, I'd probably like you to say it for me.
Or maybe you change your thinking. I don't know. But we should focus our energy on being people, Pacific people, rather than leaping to bearing the weight of the world. Because in order to bear the weight of the world in a way that is consistent with the story that we are a part of as Christians, we need to be shaped as people who can respond to violence creatively and do something different than fight or flight. So I don't know if that reminds you of what you initially said to me, but...
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just. I mean, how peace is made is just much more complicated, in some ways. And I think one of the reasons this maybe gets into it. I think we are people who are called to follow Jesus. And Paul is someone who showed us how to follow Jesus and taught us about following Jesus. And but we're also, Jesus seems to call us to a creative and an imaginative way of dealing with violence by not reciprocating the violence, by sort of ending this perpetual cycle. And we start there, I think. I think we start there. But I guess I think somehow it must include some way of also bearing the weight of the world, of being violent in some way. I think I'm confusing myself here. But so I was just going to say, we start with Matthew 5. We start with Romans 12. But we have to say there's space for Romans 13. And so that's what I think when it's at its best, the just war tradition is trying to do. How do we sort of live in both of these things. Did that make sense? I think I might have confused things more.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the starting, I guess, with Matthew 5, in part, I guess, it's what I'm concerned to preserve is the moral formation of a person who can bear the weight of the world.
Yes, it has to start, yeah.
Without some, in some weird way, loving the violence.
Yeah, like Augustine wanted to create sad, reluctant soldiers, but who were soldiers nonetheless. Like, they would wish this wasn't going on, but realizing they need to do it. Like, there is a formation that happens. Jesus is calling us to become a certain type of person. I think Ben was next.
I just wondering if I was interested by the definition that Andy Crouch offered of violence. Mm-hmm. Force intended to damage, undermining the dignity, doesn't respect the object limits, and intended good. So it seems to me that I'm struggling with definitions here because
yeah.
It seems to me that is something that Christians should, to the best of their ability, never engage in. Mm-hmm. But there has to be a distinction between that and force of some kind. Is it intentionally undermining the dignity of something, for instance, preventing an invading army from doing something horrible, you're not, the purpose of that is not to undermine the dignity of those soldiers who are invading.
Yeah.
It's to prevent them from undermining the dignity.
Right.
So I just wonder whether there's a helpful distinction or a distinction to be made between force, which may be necessary sometimes, and violence. Because I look at that definition, and it's a helpful definition to me, but to me, I think this is not something that even Christians involve in the state. They should be working against it in every way.
Yeah.
But maybe willing to support force. Yeah.
And that's why I wanted to say that nonviolence is a confrontation as well. But I want to say that, you know, I guess I see humans as we shouldn't murder other people. Like, it's always a tragedy that murder has to happen. Mm-hmm. But there are times where it's justifiable in some sense.
Wait, and wait a minute.
Murder or kill?
Oh, kill. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry, yeah. No, thank you. Yeah, where killing is... I still have a hard time not knowing how, like, that, even if it's justifiable, doesn't undermine someone's dignity, I guess, in some way. And but that's, I think, part of perhaps bearing the weight of the world, like I was saying, like living in a fallen world. I don't think the Bible sort of gives, or the New Testament gives sort of like approval for just any sort of violence, or like it's always something that's a tragic thing.
My mind is going pretty much the same direction as Ben's was in some wanting to make a distinction between force and violence. And what's coming to my mind is having a son who's a state trooper and who's had a lot of experiences himself, and well, we hear on the news a lot about police officers who are meant to be enforcing the law and protecting innocent people from mm-hmm. harm, but who lose their control and actually do, their force becomes violence.
Mm-hmm.
Has become, and these are the stories we hear mostly about.
Yeah.
But I hear a lot of stories from Chris and from his experience and a lot of other police officers who don't do that. In other words, they stop a violent criminal without who is screaming and swearing at them and calling them horrible names without responding in kind, but who cuff them and who may have to whack them to restrain them. But I don't think I want to call that violence.
That's why I said violence is force that is intended to damage. So I don't think all force is violence. I mean, you can. I think a lot of it, and maybe it's not the most helpful definition, but it seems like so much of it has to do with intention. Because like a surgeon will cut you open to save your life, and I don't know, a rival gang member might cut you open to take your life, and so those, they're both using force. I don't think all force is wrong. But violence, I think, is a particular type of force that has an intention, this intention to damage or undermine dignity. And I think people like your son probably are in situations where that's, like it can be potentially unavoidable. Like, what else do you do in some of these in some of these moments?
Yeah, force is unavoidable if they're going to do their job and if they're going to protect innocent people from more harm. But part of it, part of the respecting the dignity is then, you know, you may have to take the person that you've cuffed and you've had to restrain to the hospital. Which Chris has had to do, to take care of his...
Yeah.
And again, restraint, I mean, what's called on is very much the kind of thing you read from Proverbs, of self-control, self-restraint, and the ability to do your job without getting all, you know, emotional and reacting against the person somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult. Not something I couldn't do.
I'd have a hard time too. I saw. I think maybe Dominic was.
It's interesting as you make that distinction between Pacific and Atlantic. I've worked closely with the military for most of my working life, and being a force and then moving into a violent confrontational activity often is a corporate act, primarily instigated by politicians, whether they make a wise choice or not, whether they use any of the biblical standards or even just war theory. The actual troops on the ground are caught up and forced in many ways because of things outside their control.
Yeah.
Whereas I see the pacifist side from Jesus' commands and Paul's as it's starting individually. I work that characteristic, that Christ-likeness in me, and like the woman in Liberia, starts it as a choice of my own, draw people like-minded to stand up and make a statement and try to correct the evil, the wrong, the violence that I see. As a group who are making choices and kind of controlling that activity among themselves. The stories about Chris and his activity as a trooper, in many ways, is indicative of his personal character, his training, his discipline. And oftentimes it is either one or two working into a situation. But as we do it state by state, country by country, the nuance, the controlling of not just the decision, but the reporting of what has actually happened is controlled way beyond me, my unit, my division, even larger from the general down. And that, in many ways, making rules to fight war is absurd to me. And the just war theory is very hard from my perspective over the years, and talking with the military who have gone in harm's way, they see it as they're the puppets of wrong or right decisions. So, to become the person that carries the weight of the world on my shoulder, it's harder because you are faced with compromise all the time as your choice moves into the final decision, whether you're on military staff or you're in Congress over the military making these decisions. So, it's an ongoing process, I think. There's no real easy answers, but as a state, as we own whatever happens by our own military and behind that our political decision, it's difficult. So it's the individual to stand up and bring whoever makes those final decisions to light and to own those things.
Don't you think, this is something about the difficulty of just war, don't you think our military is trained to operate with some degree of restraint, I mean, towards civilians, for example? I don't think it's a strong attempt to contain the violence?
I would say, initially, yes. We like that in our idea of our military. I think there are aspects of training that put that into consideration. But I know personally people who have gone into war,
right,
and with the idea that they are to be done to as I choose. When I go into battle, I will try and kill everything that looks as an opposition to me.
Right.
So there's that internal desire, that Charles Bronson, if any of you remember, that revenge aspect.
Right.
They're a threat. I will neutralize the threat. as opposed to the controlled training that I am given. And I think our traditional based values of restraint is a good word, that the other person is somewhat human and we should try and minimize our damage to them, the opposition, has slid away as our training for just moral, our moral training has slid away in our country.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I think, well, there's one proponent of okay, he's writing on or talking about the just war thing is saying, like, if it's just a checklist that you're gonna, like, you get in your head before you go into war, like, you will never well, and if, I don't even think it's just true just for war, but for anyone really in the world, like, life is a pressure cooker, and you can have all these great aspirations to be, to do this or to do this or not do this or not do this, but if you haven't been if you haven't developed character in a certain way or been transformed into a certain type of person, things like fight or flight are they come back. And I think maybe that's
I read some of the accounts of the Iraq War. I can't claim I've had a little bit of contact with the military in my career also, but I've seen some really good training. I read some of the accounts of the Iraq War when they were trying to do counterinsurgency and not alienate people. And one of the generals who was really good at propounding a restraint said that one third of his guys got it, one third of them were puzzled and couldn't figure out how to handle it, and one third of them didn't care. And so there was this a mix.
Yeah. And I use the Iraqi war because it's so fresh. I could go back to the Vietnam time for some of us for remembering those years as well.
Did you have your hand up, Sue? Or did you?
I did a slightly different.
Go for it.
So coming back to Sarah's question, do you think then, going back even further, probably being a conscientious objector is absconding from taking on the weight or becoming pacific people?
Yeah.
Like taking on that work of
I mean, maybe not necessarily. You know, I think looking at the wars we've fought or are engaged in recently, I think it would be hard. I mean, just even looking at the just war.
Depends on the war.
Yeah, I think it just depends on the war, on the and kind of who the person is. Like, one of the things that I think is fascinating in the old Testament, in Deuteronomy, it's 18 or 20. It talks about Israel's warfare policy, and it's very bizarre or very counterintuitive, because there's no standing military. The ideal is that there's no standing military, and they give all of these reasons you can exempt yourself, and one of them is if you planted vineyards and they're about, and it's time for harvest. Well, you shouldn't. You should do your harvest. Don't go to war. Or if you just got married, don't go to war. Like, you're married. Get you, like, you know, hang out with your wife. And there's a few other.
If you're afraid.
If you're afraid. If you don't want to do it, don't go. So I think there's always plenty of reasons. To be. And I think, again, I don't think violence or war are, again, the ultimate or final form of power in the world. Like, I think we can see from others. But,
I mean, going back to what you were saying, do you want to, as your own person making your own choice, be part of the story of this war as a soldier? Does that want to be part of your story? Are you killing people? As if someone who's a part of Christ.
Sometimes I think it has to be.
I disagree.
I'm
say the Iraqi war then. We use that as a very concise example. Do you want to be part of a war where they use as just cause met weapons of mass destruction, which we kind of felt was a bit bogus, and have now proven that it was not based on anything else. It was actually based on rumors, and I think that you want to be part of that.
Answering that,
no,
yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people,
there's a lot of different kind of wars, though.
Yeah. What about World War II?
Yeah. Well, even, I was just saying, can I finish? Yeah.
This is the problem I have with this just war theory, is that all of these different things to check off are things you can easily fake or change later to fit your purposes.
Yeah, I agree. I said that, actually.
There are plenty of doctors who cut with the intention to cure. And in fact, there was a whole movement of cutting people to cure their mental illnesses by giving them lobotomies that we've now proven to be very unjust and very violent, in fact, to especially women who were trying to stand up for themselves for the lobotomy.
Yeah. And
I don't see any worth in those 7 points because they could be applied to the Socialist Party in Germany equally as well as a war that we would say maybe they should have acted. Like, maybe they should have acted more in Rwanda.
Yeah, and I thought I did say that these are pretty often very slippery and subjective, mm-hmm. and that as public policy, they're easy to make them fit into whatever, but even if it's the issue of war, I think for me it's something like the police force, like police to keep peace in a state sometimes have to employ.
I think
everybody has had problems with it,
I think
at least having something. Some sort of criteria to say why we have a problem with them as well, or how it could be done. Because I just feel like if we had no police, no things like that, like it would be a pretty chaotic society.
Very
like I
violent.
Guess, yeah, very violent. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the many problems with the just war theory is that it really applies to the top of the chain of command almost entirely. And the real decisions that are made here on so many of these are made by the top. Even generals have to obey, what does proportional mean? What is a last resort? And so, I hate to say this, but it really matters who our president is.
Sure does.
it's a terrible time to have to say that. But it's, to me, because I decided I didn't like the idea of Vietnam as a war, not because I was a pacifist, because I thought I really have a clue if this is really where we ought to be. I went into the National Guard, which at that point meant that I wouldn't go abroad, wouldn't go to war there unless it was World War III, in which case I was willing to do that. But I think we need to. The just war theory is easily able to be deceived around and made to work. But it's better than no theory.
Yeah.
What is no theory?
No theory.
What is no standards whatsoever about when to go to war or when to not go to war? That's the problem, is that the alternative to that, you could approve it and tweak it, but having no criteria, not bringing any moral criterion at all into when to go to war or not is far worse. And like maybe you say a word about this guy Bell or whatever, mm-hmm. who's picking up a little bit on what Sarah said, is that he was saying, just you can expand on this, but saying if a checklist is never going to do any good, it can only do good if someone really values human life. Mm-hmm. This can only be usable and fruitful in the hands of someone who really loves people. And without that, forget it. It'll be manipulated, it'll be rationalized, it'll be, you could do anything with it. It's still better than nothing, because it's some sort of criterion, but we're really kidding the tragedy of being a human being.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
The deep, deep tragedy of being a human being in our collective reality, where war is, and here again, on the ground, I mean, all of us are probably talking to people who've been, I've never been in actual combat, I've never talked to plenty of people who have, but things are desperate because your buddies are killed, and
coming at you with a bayonet,
and you will kill anybody inside. It was your enemy, and that will be fulfilling the orders that you've been given. To not do that would be not fulfilling the orders. So for someone on the ground, it's a brutal, brutal situation. And the distinction between non-combatants and combatants is really hard to maintain today. A huge amount of the combat is the industrial base that turns out all the military hardware that makes war possible. But I think we can look at the problems of it, but still say, with the just war theory, but say, hey, we need something. But we need something that's believed by someone who actually cares for people and loves people and values people. Otherwise, and watch out who we have at the top of the chain of command.
And again, I mean, just the quote I also read from this guy, Arthur Holmes, like, the just war theory isn't a celebration of war or even a concession that war is, or violence is the most powerful means of getting things done in the world. Like, he says war is evil. I mean, he says everything that... I think most pacifists say. I think there's a tremendous amount they're much closer to one another in that they think it's abhorrent and it's a tragedy. The response, of course, is different. The engagement is different.
Just two things. One of them, I'm just so struck wherever the place is in the Old Testament, where in one of the historical books it talks about it was springtime when. Everyone, when kings went out to war.
Yes, David.
And what a horrible thing, you know.
And
but
David didn't make a temple because he had blood on his hands.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so God, he made too many wars, and they weren't all justifiable.
Yeah.
But this is changing a little bit from war, but it. Cover article, I think it's a cover article. The Time magazine is all about how evangelicals who are endorsing Donald Trump, how Jerry Falwell at Liberty University endorsing him, and how Trump loves the place because concealed weapons are allowed on campus. How does that fit? The idea of allowing concealed weapons. What about gun laws? What about, I don't know. That drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Number five, last resort.
Yeah,
Hold on. I'm just curious. And I saw a few hands that haven't said anything yet. Do you?
I was just going to point out, maybe it's just so obvious it doesn't need to be said, but there's an obvious, huge counterexample on the other side of the equation, which would be, obviously, that Hitler needed to be stopped. And
absolutely.
Force needed to be applied to stop that. So that, I mean, there hasn't been much of a arguably just war since then, but in that case, certainly, it had to be done.
Absolutely.
And I have to say that from our history, our American history, after our wars, we have eventually gone back to our enemy, have made peace, and attempted to reconcile not just politically, but physically, by helping rebuild Germany, our most recent attempts to Vietnam to deal with that.
In Japan.
Japan.
Afghanistan,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So we don't see that a lot in other countries throughout history doing much of that at all. And I have to say there's some residual Christian biblical base of reconciling not just utilitarian but just a moral imperative that we should be doing.
Tom?
Yeah, what was Jesus saying about suffering when he said that how many swords do we have? I've just never figured that out.
Where is that?
At the end of the Last Supper.
To Luke, I think.
In Luke, Last Supper, he says, okay, now I'm leaving. Check how many swords we have. And Peter says, we've got two or three. Good, Jesus is good. That's enough. And they go off, and Peter uses one of the swords to cut off try to slice probably sort of cut a guy down the middle, and the guy stopped his head and just lost his ear.
And Jesus told him to put the sword away.
Put the sword away. But what, I mean, I've never figured that out. He said, I wish I could remember what his preface was. He said, now I'm leaving you, he's going to need, I don't forget what he said. But I know this was a couple.
We're just
going to
buy
a Bible.
We'll all go read that.
Okay, I just wondered if you didn't have a discussion. I have no idea what.
No, I just have a question.
There's a Bible.
Sarah?
I'm just struck by your examples, the story that you began with, and the story from the civil rights movement, and the context of social, political minority that early Christians were in, and you know, as were those two stories, and how fraught we are as 21st century American Christians, because we live in a time where we have power, political, we're losing our social power as Christians, but to be, it just, you know, as American citizens alone, We're not the military minority in the world, and so I don't know. I'm verbally processing how much that makes this all the more difficult to think creatively about nonviolence when power is so ready at hand. And like, how do we keep ourselves in touch with releasing power, releasing to not defend our power, or to use it in ways where we just, where that's an impulse rather than a last resort. And I actually think like the distinction between force and violence is really helpful. I was going to ask you, like, okay, so the rubber hits the road for me with Jacob wanting to buy a Nerf gun. Mm-hmm. And that's a totally loaded thing for me, because it's not, you know, like, it's a Nerf gun. I get this, it's a Nerf gun. but gun. Of course, you know. And it occurs to me tonight, like, he is trying to come to terms, or not to come to terms, but to, like, have a good sense of his force in the world. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, like, how do we shape our children and ourselves, like a good honing of our, I feel like I'm just talking Star Wars now, but like force, you know, so that force can be put in into service of the good, you know, but that it's not so quickly jump to power that would, you know, be violent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think a big part is like living in the story of Jesus, like immersing ourselves like in the Gospels. Like, one of the things that I didn't say, but that I'd read that was really interesting is many times in the New Testament when sort of the apostolic writers, so after the Gospels, talk about, like, what would Jesus do? And it's mostly, like, we're to imitate his life of absorbing violence and not retaliating. Like, that's the main thing. So when Paul talks about being single and how being single is a good thing, he never once says, well, Jesus was single, so therefore it's a good thing. Like, he uses other ways to talk about the truth that it's a good thing. Or when Paul justifies his, you know, that he could not, he could just receive money for doing ministry, but instead he works. He could have said, well, Jesus received money for his ministry, and he, you know, he lived off of others. Like, I could do that too. But where the New Testament writers often talk about imitate or what Jesus would do, or what example he set for us, is for kind of suffering unjustly and absorbing that and taking that. And so so I don't know, I think it has to start in some sense where, like, you know, for us to think Jesus shows us, I mean, not just think, believe that Jesus really shows us what it means to be human and what God is ultimately like and what we're supposed to be like. But,
I mean, children.
What's that?
And that your child will watch how you react.
Yeah, I think these things are caught sometimes more than they're taught, you know. And, but having cultures in our families. Sue, do you want to keep going?
Just one little point. In this type of discussion, I usually, well, I find it fairly hopeless discussion, to be honest, but I always think that there's a difference between discussing it on a personal level and then at a national level,
yeah.
An international level. The national and international seems so far beyond anything I could ever have control over, except, of course, you all have the power to vote. I don't in this country, but you all do, so that does make a difference. However, I am encouraged by something that happened in my country. 20 years ago, there was a mass shooting in Tasmania, and I don't have the dates in my head as well as you do, but just after that, the then Prime Minister, John Howard, who a lot of people thought was a fairly ineffectual person, brought in very strict gun laws and removed all handguns and other guns from people. And since those laws were brought into practice, the numbers of mortalities from gun violence just plummeted. It's practically nothing. Now, I realise Australia has a minuscule population compared to America. And when I think of gun laws in America, I just feel it's, I feel absolutely hopeless about it. You just cannot change America's attitude to gun laws. But it can happen, I think, even at a grassroots level. And again, it's getting back to this affecting those around you, affecting your local community, affecting your church. What if I'm the only person at church who doesn't own a gun? Then maybe it's my relationship with those people who do that. That should be where I am affecting people.
Mm-hmm. I think Abigail had her hand up before, unless...
I was just wondering if you've heard the toga theory of turning the other cheek, explaining that parable through a Roman custom. So when you wore a toga, you had all looped over your left arm. So the only appropriate way to chastise your servant was to give them a bitch slap with the back of your hand. If you use your palm or your fist, you're considered barbaric and would be shunned by your neighbors because you were not a true Roman citizen. So by turning the other cheek, you're inviting the person that you met to really hit me and showing how barbaric you are. And that's the toga theory of turning the other cheek.
I haven't heard
and
that.
It's very much like your first example. When you're going to a restaurant, she said, "Are you going to arrest me when I make it? Basically, are you going to show what you're really doing to women in Liberia?"
I haven't heard of the toga one before. I just started not saying as many things, but that I had written down. But what I read, a lot of commentators said was Israel Jewish culture was a shame-based culture, and to hit someone on the right cheek, most people were right-handed, so you'd have to hit them that way. And it's interesting, there's a legal fine for slapping someone backhandedly is twice as high as if you hit them with the palm of your hand. So it's 200 zuz if it's the palm of your hand, but it's 400 zuz if it's backhand. So it's a way of adding shame. I did, in Luke, where it said in Luke, it just said if someone strikes you on the cheek. So if someone slugs you, basically. But I haven't heard that. I haven't heard that before. Yeah, it's a toga thing. I think Tom was...
I mean, you were talking about weapons. I mean, several years ago, almost 20 years ago, I taught at a Christian school, had a student in Canada. He was a fine kid. He ended up in New Hampshire working at a 7-Eleven late at night. Mm-hmm. He was in the national news. He was working late at night, bad section of town, he was in a bad section of town. He carried a legal handgun. In walked a crazy guy, pulled out a knife, said, "I want your money," walked around the town, said, "I'm going to kill you." Shannon pulled out the gun, said, you might want to reconsider your options. The guy reconsidered and left, and Shannon was fired for breaking company policy.
Wow.
So, ask yourself, I mean, you know, you're living in a violent culture. He correctly saw that he was living in a dangerous place, that his employer didn't provide any security for him, that his life was at risk. He took legal precautions, used them with restraint, and did not submit to the commercially governing authority, saved his life and lost his job. What do you do?
That's a good story.
It's a true story, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the kid, I know his mom and his dad, and I mean, so...
Is Liberty University a dangerous place where people need to have...
I was not trying to make that point.
I will say, however, my niece just graduated from Liberty.
Yeah.
And I haven't even asked her. She's been out for a year now, and I don't know how she feels about the concealed gun. I'll have to ask her. I'll see her next week. But she has said on several occasions their convocation, they're required to attend, and there are literally thousands of them in this convocation. And she said, we feel like sitting ducks. And we feel that if somebody wanted to come in and make a statement against Christians, that we're a bunch of Christian kids all in this one area together, and that if somebody wanted to come in, it would not be hard to do. And I've heard her say that a couple
times. And then just imagine the picture. They all take out their guns and shoot. What is that?
I don't know.
I know. I guess I, well... Yeah, it just, again, I just... Well... It's not as though Liberty University is. Right. Well, anyway, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how to say that. It strikes me as that's a potentially unfounded fear, as it's in rural Virginia.
Yeah.
And I mean, any public.
I'd be more afraid of going to the University of Texas with their history of. Fraternities and fraternity parties, and you know that there it's good, it's illegal to carry a concealed weapon. What happens to concealed weapons at fraternity parties when everybody roaring drunk?
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
Were you going to say something, Cody, or just scratching your head?
I'll
go ahead and or.
I was just going to make a comment that there's the balance of the New Testament with the epistles where the church is really encouraged to not devour itself. And I think this thing would be a peacemaker, and violence can be without using any kind of moral threat. But character assassination and character degradation is prolific. And I've been in the audience receiving and know of others who have received as well. And I think that what we're talking about here is if Christians are losing critical mass in our national character profile, then we really need to rethink how we embrace one another. And the idea of keeping peace or being a peacemaker is a radical distinction, just like violence and force. So I think that this is something that, before we start talking about it on a multicultural level, I think we need to really examine who we are as Christians at core and how diverse we are in our expressions and our perspectives. And be a peacemaker, the greater part of our effort should be to build bridges to one another within a social construct so that we can then effectively inform and inspire those that govern us at the highest echelons. And I personally, in my 15 years, have found that an extremely difficult project to sustain any kind of momentum in. And I think that if we're going to be, as Christ is exemplified, in the smallest spheres of influence, that's what we need to be vigilant. The closest relationships we continue to build with. On a practical level, in our little town of Mariposa, we've established a thing called the Sheriff's Ambassadors. And essentially what we are is we are a hospitality-embracing arm of law enforcement. whatever anybody needs, we find a way, the shortest way possible, to get what they need to help. But to get response and people who want to participate in that, virtually zero. Mm-hmm. And especially among evangelicals. Mm-hmm. It's ironic to me that we cannot extend the table of hospitality. And at the root of it all is the so-called thing of doctrinal or devotional purity. And I really struggle with that, that we have those nuances that are so dominant. And again, maybe my region where we live, it's pretty easy in rural Mariposa to see it, but it's very, very powerful. And to just knock someone's legs out from under because you disagree with them about some minor doctrinal perspective, whatever, it just really, to me, that just is horrendous violence.
Could you clarify something you said? You said you had a hard time getting people to join the hospitality outreach. Do you think the doctrinal purity is stopping you from doing that?
Some of it is. Some of, in our region, if you don't think like they think, you ain't one.
Wow.
So,
I agree with you. I've seen doctrinal purity split on all sorts of levels, but to actually prevent people from being hospitable or joining in shoulder to shoulder to be hospitable, that's another level.
Well, doesn't it do the opposite sometimes? Like, encourage people to push down the people who are not doctrinal pure?
Yeah.
To not only not help them, but purposely
neglect. Oh, yeah.
It's a weird kind of confession, but when you're living in it and you're voicing your concern with that and you're discovering that the majority of people really don't care, they don't want to. They're that 1/3 who goes, I don't give a rip. I'm going to pull out my whatever weaponry I have, I'm going to go after them because I want to win. I want to control. I want to rule. So this will to power, all of these things, it is deeply seated. And I know we haven't really discussed much, but I mean, you guys know our history and you know our little community. And to me, it's embarrassing. It is utterly embarrassing that this message that we preach, that we are a transformed people, is just so seldom actually genuinely experienced. That's just irony of ironies. Mm-hmm. So I think the nonviolence or the peacemaking distinction, I think if every child who calls himself a Christian actually asks themselves what that means, would have a good deal to confess and repent and to be delivered of. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd see a transformation. But until we get to the place where we want to serve rather than being served, mm-hmm. and to participate rather than to control, we're going to have that. We're going to have that King Abel issue the whole time. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to transform a world when we can't even ourselves mm-hmm. experience entering into a kingdom that has to be believed and made allowance for it to actually see it? Mm-hmm. So, this is a difficult subject, man. I mean, that was just such a broad brush stroke. I mean, it's wildly huge. All I can say is I'm proud of you, man.
And on that note, well, did you have your hand up again?
I was surprised you didn't use the triumphal entry as an example of how God does triumph versus how people do triumph. The way kings put in Jerusalem, army marching in front of them, and then the bombs, uh-huh. and then the tanks, and then more army, and then the leader on the horse, which is a symbol of military strength. Uh-huh. And that's not what Jesus did. Uh-huh. And what was his symbol of his triumph?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was a call that hadn't been ridden before. I was freaking out. I needed his mom there to calm him down. A donkey. A beast of burden.
Yeah, no, that's a good passage. Yeah, Dominic.
A couple of the comments, the last comments, reminded me of the picture of Nietzsche.
I can put it back up if you want.
It's that grace, reconciliation, forgiveness are not values of our heroes. The values of our heroes are more what Nietzsche has advocated over his time. And have, you know, again, we see the raw public exposure of our most basic ideas and thoughts that I have for you, and I have the freedom and the right to express that openly now, whereas being gracious and civil with my words, trying to reconcile, use language that is building bridges, they're not a value now. And so as we, in a community, a body of Christ, how do we, as Mike was saying, build that as a value and extol our picture of what a hero is with those guys. Mm-hmm. And of course, it should be our primary hero is Christ, mm-hmm. and how he treated even his own enemies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sinless like him. And I know I have base instincts. My sinful nature wants to lash out.
A connection was made in my mind, and maybe I'll say this, and then it makes no connection to what you just said, and so I apologize in advance. But before being here, I had different jobs throughout my life, and one of them was I worked in a social housing nonprofit, and I worked nights, and it was a rough neighborhood. 50 people in the building, all intravenous drug users, illicit forms of work, mental health issues. I mean, it was a place where there was a lot, a lot of violence. And we quite regularly called the police. I would be in the office, and I could see on the, because we had cameras, in different places, and I could see when, like, which officer would come. And, some nights you call and it's like 6 hours later someone comes. Just if it depends on what you're calling for. And depending on the cop that came, like, that I could see at the door, because I got to know a number of them, at least by their face, if not, I didn't really know many of their names. But a number of them, I was like, this guy's just going to make things worse. Things are about to get worse here than better. And there was this red-headed Irish, which I know is stereotypical, cop who was working in Vancouver. And when I saw that red hair on the camera, I was like, things are going to be great. He's going to take care of this. And he was someone who, he was kind of a hero to me, because I would watch him, because he knew how to take a situation that was rising, and not by being a tough guy, just bring it down and resolve it. And it was something that he developed. He was a type of, he'd been a cop for years. And he knew how to respect people and talk to people. And he was someone who I sort of modeled my work there, or tried to emulate my work there off of. Because, I just had never been in a place before where people called me such awful things, like, on an hourly basis, if not more regular, and people would just say these things about me, and I was you don't know me, I think what you're saying is right, and it is really, really easy for me to read blogs and to read news and to think, police are awful, police are all the problems, but then I have to remember this redheaded police officer who was someone who made peace, and he's someone who, and again, he never specifically taught me anything, but I caught things from him on how to work in escalating situations. And he's someone who, I wish I got his name. I was working nights. I was exhausted for 3 years. I just was a zombie. But he was someone who inspired me, I guess. So.
See, the sad thing is they don't make the news.
Yeah, he'll never make the news. He'll never make the news.
You know, the other really sad thing, the policeman who shot Michael Brown was that type of a policeman. Mm-hmm. Turns out that he recognized, I've read a story about him, about people who trained him. And they said he recognized he wasn't fitting in, wasn't working in the community. Mm-hmm. He spotted a red-haired cop.
Yeah.
The officer says, "I need help, man." Mm-hmm. He says, "I don't know. I don't get it. I'm making things worse. Mm-hmm. How can I make them better?" And the guy who trained him was the only man in his whole career who ever asked him for help. Mm-hmm. And the guy actually got quite good. And now he's. No, I can't speak to the whole story, but the shame is that he himself, it's just what the media, you know, we got to give a side of the story.
I love that your story there, because it's a picture of what, even for a police officer who comes into a really charged situation, force is they're not coming to with the purpose of exerting force.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're coming with the purpose of de-escalation.
Yeah.
And that's what good policing is.
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually what keep not just law enforcement, but keeping the peace.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. It doesn't make the news, because those are the nights when nobody gets shot.
Yeah. And it takes like a certain type of person. Like
right.
He's someone who's a lot of times, actually, the from my experience, so this is just anecdotal, the police officers that were trouble were young, and they were there to prove a point, and actually were really did feel like they were there to exert force,
yeah.
And were just waiting for
the
slightest breach to
to
show that they were tough, but. All right.
Well,
going.
Thank you.
Going.